Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What was the very worst thing that happened to you in the dreadful years of middle school? Can you still recall the sense that you simply didn't fit in and never would? For 12-year-old Charlie Drinkwater, life is hard enough when he's only the smallest, skinniest kid in seventh grade, trying desperately to keep his hulking nemesis from discovering that his middle name is Elmer. On a popularity scale of 1 to 10, Charlie rates himself a 0. But things take a crazy turn when one school day, Charlie finds himself transmogrifying into an 8-foot dinosaur, albeit one still terrified enough of the school bully to hand over his allowance money. The story is called The Creature from the Seventh Grade. It's the first in a new series by writer, actor, and director Bob Balaban, who you've seen on screen in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Gosford Park, Best in Show, Moonrise Kingdom, and nearly 100 other roles. He joins us now to talk about the new book and about his 5-decade artistic career. Bob, welcome to Think.
Hello. I have to say, when I was listening with my other ear to you announcing that I was coming on and you said that my middle name was Elmer, I went, don't tell them. I don't want them to know. It never goes away, does it?
That's actually your middle name as well as Charlie's.
Oh, yes. We share many things.
You know, the striking thing, I think, about the voice you've created for this character is that he laments all these things that make him feel like an outsider, and he has no sense that any of this could ever change. And it's that singular tunnel vision of middle school.
It's the thing that I want people to have fun and read it because it's enjoyable, but the thing I most hope that people take away with them is this sense that if only you could have a little perspective, you would look back and see that you will not only get through it, the qualities that made you be different most of the time when you're a little kid are the same things that enable you to succeed in the world. They just don't let you succeed when you're little.
You know, it's funny about that because I think a lot of parents do everything they can to keep their kids from being the weird one.
Well, I think we all do, and we have to remember our parents see us, and we tend to see our children as little extensions of ourselves. So, you know, we impose upon them everything that we wish for ourselves, which is, you know, I want them to fit in, I want them to be like everybody else, I want them to be successful. And often the things that I think we wish in our children might be the exact things that will keep them from being successful. I mean, it could be. They're individuals. They need to be whoever they are.
I love that in the book, Charlie goes through this really bizarre change, and his parents are completely unfazed by the whole thing, which also astonishes him.
Well, it was interesting. I had to find, my editor was really helpful with this, because in the beginning, this was a title that I came up with because I wanted to think of another kid's book. I had written a series of fairly successful books about 10 years ago called McGrawl, about a little boy and his bionic dog. And I thought, well, it's time for me to do this again. So I simply came up with the title for something, but I didn't know who he would really be. So it took me a while to come up with this, but I did try to figure out somebody that was pretty much like me. I just wanted to add something fantastic to it, so that's why he had to turn into a dinosaur, and yet he really stays the same.
Mm-hmm. I gather, you know, he finally discovers that he can make people laugh, and I wonder if you remember that moment in your own young life when you thought, oh, I'm funny.
Well, I never quite made it to thinking I was funny, but I did notice that it's the time I most easily got along with people was when they were laughing at me. So yeah, I was in a very odd and small class myself, but I was the class clown. So it seemed like a natural thing to turn Charlie into. It's sort of why Jews have survived through the ages, because somebody said once, why are there so many Jewish comedians? It's like when everybody is killing you all the time, you either find a way to be funny about it, or you're just too depressing and you fade away.
Hmm. Yeah, and I suppose it's a combination of making friends on the other side and also finding something within yourself to value.
Yeah, it's a coping skill, I would say, yeah.
So I read somewhere that when you were a kid, you did these, I don't know if this is the right term, like avant-garde puppet shows for your family.
Yes, unfortunately. It's bad enough you should force your relatives to come to these puppet shows, but at least they can have a story. Mine were sort of Brechtian, I must say. And I charge money for these things, too. You know, you had to pay a nickel to come and see my horrible puppet shows in my room. And I don't remember them too well because they didn't have plots. They were a little hard to hold on to. But at one point, I do remember, I cringed that I did this, but I was little enough not to care. I replaced all the puppets in one show with myself. I was very small, and I remembered crawling into my puppet show. And I thought, oh, God, Mom and Daddy, you know, if you were only reading the signs, you would see this actor forming in front of you. But they didn't seem to notice too much at the time.
And I guess charging for a performance was something that your family was quite familiar with.
I have to say, yes, it's what saved the family that my grandmother, who was doing terribly in the delicatessen business on the Lower East Side of Chicago, Maxwell Street, in 1908, decided when she saw a Nickelodeon for the first time, you had to give your nickel before you went in to get what you were getting. Hmm. And it saved the family from ruination, basically. They went into the movie business, and they didn't have to throw away their own lettuce, which they were doing a lot of.
So by the time you were a kid, the family business was quite established. I mean, did that mean to you, okay, I have a future in the performing
arts? By the time I was a kid, the family business was on the way out, I have to say, because TV had so successfully damaged. I mean, it's still, you know, distribution, and I mean, exhibition is still a sort of a decent trade, I suppose. But it had been so fantastic that the dent that television made was very heavy on the family, and they sold most of their theaters at that time. My dad was a pioneer in radio and television, which seemed somewhat removed from me from show business. I don't know why, because it's certainly not anymore. But no, I didn't feel I had anything to go into, and I sort of figured I'd be a writer, so that's how I kind of began in my mind. And then, much to my total surprise, I began getting work. I went to Colgate University for my first year and a half for the simple reason that I got in and I couldn't think of anywhere else to go. I had no plan of any kind. So I got there and I went, oh, I got to get to New York. Maybe I'll do something if I get to New York. I did, and I got into a play. I was in You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. I was the original Linus in that. And then in my senior year, I got into a play that Mike Nichols was directing, and then he cast me in the movie Catch-22. And much completely to my surprise, and it still surprises me that anybody would hire me, I started having something of a career. But I didn't think that would happen.
Do you remember, you're sort of right on the line, I think, age-wise. Do you remember when the first television set came into your house?
Yes, totally. Well, not television set, because truthfully, my family being in, my dad being in TV, and his brothers actually in 1948 started a television station in Chicago.
Wow.
Called WBKB. It became Channel 7. There was a TV in my house from the time I remember, you know, being born. But what I really remember was having the first color TV in my entire, you know, there was nobody that I knew who had a color TV but me. And it's, you know, my father had television stations at that point, and he had to have one. And that was unbearably exciting. I sat 3 inches away from the television set, studying it, trying to figure out how the color got in there. I still, of course, have no idea how it gets there. And I seem to remember that it was far more crisp, clear, and wonderful than it was for many years to come. But I don't know. It could be just the glowing memory of, you know, when you're little and you think remember things. They seem to have been much more wonderful, like the way things tasted always. I've never had watermelon as good as when I was 7 years old. I don't know that it really got so worse, but that's how I remember it.
Hmm. Did the technical side of directing, when you're directing movies and television, did that always come easily to you, or was it something that you really had to work to get down?
Well, I'm not such a genius at it, but I did something that was really remarkably helpful with a very generous friend of mine. I had actually directed a play or two along the way, and strangely didn't find it too engaging. Joe Papp let me direct something at the Public Theater, and I remembered thinking, because I must not have been ready for it at the time, I remember thinking, oh, actors are so needy, oh, you know, you just have to hold them up all the time, you know, when do you get to direct the play? And I don't know what happened. I certainly feel a lot different now. I have enormous respect and admiration for most of the actors that I work with. I mean, granted, I suppose I'm an actor, but sometimes that makes it worse, I guess. But I worked with Sidney Lumet. He directed a wonderful movie called Prince of the City. I don't remember what year. I was about 32 or 3 or something like that. It was relatively early on. And I just loved watching him direct. I'd never worked with anybody that directed the way he did. It was so fast and so intelligent and so well worked out. I really admired him. So I asked him if I could study him. And he let me apprentice myself to him for about 4 months. Which, in Sidney's case, was literally about how long it took for pre-production, making the movie, and cutting it. He was known as one of the world's fastest filmmakers, and he made some, I think, you know, enormously great movies. But he taught me a vast amount of things very, very quickly. So for one thing, I'd been, you know, I'd been in a couple of movies a year for the most part since I was about 20 years old, so I was kind of aware of how everything operated. But this was the first time that my eyes completely opened up. I saw what you actually did in pre-production, how the sound design and the scenery design could fit in with the concept of the movie and all sorts of other things. And Sidney was very generous. I would ask questions, but I didn't want to bother him. He would constantly take me aside and say, the reason we had to do 7 takes of that shot is I'm using such a long lens, my depth of field isn't great enough, and they're moving in the scene, so we keep having to change focus. So that's why usually he would do 2 takes or 3 takes. He just was a wonderful teacher, a generous man, and a great filmmaker. So I did have that. I did take a lot of film courses in school, but it's really different to be on a film set with a great director like that. And I did learn a lot of stuff, and I kind of relaxed after that. I also directed probably about 20 episodes of our television, which basically you don't necessarily become creative from that, but you eventually figure out how to shoot just about anything in just about any amount of time. And that's been very helpful to me.
And you don't necessarily with television have the kind of unlimited budget that we associate with certain kinds of movies.
Of course, no movie really had. I mean, I suppose you could say maybe Avatar had an unlimited budget, but everything has a limit. When I was doing Close Encounters of the Third Kind, a favorite movie of mine with a favorite director, one day on the set, and at this point this was a $19 million movie, which in 1977 or whatever it was more like a $200 million movie, I suppose. And I remember the movie seemed to be going pretty well, and midway through there was a scene where the mothership landed, and it started making all these noises. Remember, bomb, bomb, bomb,
sure.
Bomb. And at one point it went, boom, and all the glass started shattering and all the modules around the set. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, of course.
Well, they shattered one or two, which is what was in the budget, and Steven said, I'd like to shatter another 4 of them, which I think they do. They go, you know, cut, cut, cut. You see all these things. You see all these things being shattered. And I remember that the message came back from headquarters. It was like, no, we've spent the budget on how many glass plates we're going to, you know, plate glasses we're going to shatter. You can't do it anymore. And I remember Stephen wrote a check for whatever it was, you know, $10,000 or $2,000. I have no idea. But he said, it's okay. I'll pay for it myself. And as he said, you really never have enough money to do everything as much as you want, because you would never stop if you did. You would just do everything over and over again.
I think Americans who first saw that in 1977 will go back to it and they'll rent it or they'll watch it on TV. I mean, is it a totally different experience if you were to do that? Do you remember what happened backstage, or can you get into the story at this point?
Well, in that case, it's a little different somewhat, because I wrote a book about the making of the movie called The Close Encounters Diary, which actually now is called Spielberg, Truffaut, and Me. I'm just telling you that because I love when people buy it, and you can't buy it if you have the wrong name.
And you were literally Truffaut's translator on the set as well as on camera.
I was one of the few people who actually spoke French, and Truffaut did not like to speak English. He kind of could speak it, but it sort of embarrassed him. He was very meticulous about everything. And he also said he didn't feel that his sense of humor, which was completely dry, really came across very much when he spoke English, and he was right. People were somewhat scared of him because he seemed rather frightening and he seemed a little cold, but that was just because he didn't speak the language very much and he was kind of formal, but he was really funny and sweet and charming and warm. And I did become his translator on this, not just speaking in the movie, but he would get scripts and I would translate them. And I got to know him really well. It was a great time.
We'll talk a little bit more about that after the break. My guest is writer, actor, and director Bob Balaban. He's got a new book out called The Creature from the Seventh Grade. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is director, actor, and writer Bob Balaban. His new book is called The Creature from the Seventh Grade. It's the first in a new series for middle grade readers. We're talking to him about his entire career. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. So, Bob, you have weeks to spend at the side of François Truffaut. I mean, you were not a novice at this point. You've been working professionally for several years. Did you still, though, have to fight the play it cool? That's Truffaut. I mean, did you have
terrified.
That sense?
Yeah. But so was Stephen, and probably Dreyfus, too. They were really scared of him. And I wasn't directing the movie, don't forget. So, you know, I didn't have one of the world's great directors breathing down my neck. Mm-hmm. But two things happened with Stephen anyway. Truffaut really, really didn't want people to be in any way in awe of him. He was a really nice guy, basically. And he announced through his interpreter, because I didn't know him at the time, when he first showed up in Los Angeles and talked with Stephen, he very clearly said, I'm just an actor here. You know, I'm here to do what you tell me. I'm not gonna say a word about anything else. I'm just gonna act and shut up. And so that kind of helped. But Stephen actually was nice enough to write the introduction for my book about the movie. And I can be really uncomfortable with people. I mean, people tend to assume that actors, have an easy time because, you know, as long as you're talking, it's kind of like acting, but it's not the same thing. And I can be very much awkward with, I can be very awkward with people, especially if I'm in awe of them. But I grew to be, Truffaut was so funny, and once he caught on to the fact that in the beginning I could not speak French. I had lied to get the job. It was kind of like something you would expect of an Antoine Doinel character, maybe, you know, in one of his movies. I went in to meet with Julia Phillips and Steven Spielberg, and probably Dreyfus was at the meeting. I kind of knew him. And they said to me, you know, well, you're here to play the interpreter. So basically, when he talks in French, you'll have to say it in English, and when anybody says anything, you'll translate this. I didn't really realize at the time that I was going to actually have to translate, but, you know, I thought it would be written into the script, but it wasn't particularly. So I replied to this bunch of people, il y avait beaucoup d'années depuis que j'ai parlé français. Si vous me donnez ce boulot, ce sera très difficile pour moi, which sort of means, in some horrible French that I had worked on it with great difficulty, it's been many years since I have spoken French, and if you give me this job, I will have great difficulty. But I thought, I'm not lying. Nobody spoke French, and I got the job. So the ice was kind of broken with François because he found it very amusing that I was playing this interpreter and I had to say some very difficult things like dust the northern face of the mountain with easy for and many things like that. So he kind of thought it was funny. He could see me struggling and I'd mess up and, like, you know, 25 trucks had to back up and the plane had to take over off all over again. But Stephen was pretty much in awe of him. And then at one point... we were shooting a scene where they couldn't understand what François was saying. They thought he was speaking French, and they had to call me into this thing. And they said, what's this thing about they belong here in Mozambique? And I said, oh, they belong here more than we. It was they belong here in Mozambique, what they thought he was saying. And pretty much everybody got over it. But I got over it first because I was kind of on the inside because I spoke French.
So I have to imagine, Bob, when you are directing, you have this great empathy for the actors you're working with. Does that empathy go the other way when you are an actor and you can see a director, for whatever reason, struggling or having trouble communicating something?
I think the main thing that has happened to me sort of over the years, and I was very slow to learn this, I've gradually gotten a feeling, more from directing television probably, but, you know, I've directed probably 7 or 8 things that are like movies, whether they're movies for HBO or actual movies or whatever. I've sort of gradually dawned on me that we're all in it together. As an actor, I used to sense this giant wall between me and the camera and whoever else was outside of there. But the more I've been on sets as a director, the more I really see we're all just struggling to get through and to do our best, and we all need to kind of help each other. So it is much easier for me. I kind of see things from both sides now. I don't know if it's empathy exactly, but it's comfort, and my comfort level has mostly increased, which, I mean, anything would have made it better because, you know, it's not by mistake that for many years I only played very tense characters that everybody thought was my my character, but that's just the way I was feeling. You know, I couldn't help it. I couldn't be any way else if I tried. I'm getting a little better at it, and perhaps by the time I die, I'll be good at it. You know, who knows?
To what extent do you think that your look and the sound of your voice has shaped the kinds of roles that you've been offered?
Probably enormously, but now that I look back on it, which is funny because I don't mean to tie everything together, but I feel the same way about this creature from the seventh grade sort of message that I'm trying to send, which is things aren't always what you think they were when you look back on them. And the truth is, I was lucky enough to be in show business and in movies particularly, because plays are always different. You can be cast as anything in a play. There's no typecasting in a play, you know, really. I mean, you can't play a leading man exactly, but you know, you could do an awful lot of stuff that you would never get in a movie. In a movie, you kind of have to be who you sound like and who you are.
Yeah.
But I was kind of lucky enough, by the time the 70s rolled around, and I started acting in movies in the late 60s, during the 70s, you know, Dustin Hoffman became a movie star. I don't think anybody that short, and he's a perfectly attractive man in real life. I mean, God knows he got a lot of dates. Before he got married, he must have gone out with 300 or 400 women, I think. So he was very popular, but he wasn't popular in a movie sort of way. So I think I was very lucky. And the world was kind of changing. People accept all sorts of different people in movies. But I don't think at the time I realized that. So I sort of decided, without saying anything to myself, that I was going to be the lawyer, the professional, the kind of nerdy scientist. I mean, that's how I was getting cast. And I think it's because that's how I saw myself. I look back on it now, and I really think, as an actor, it's amazing who you can be anywhere, in a movie or anywhere, if you seriously believe in yourself. And I always suffered from, I didn't have an enormous supply of belief in myself. I did occasionally, you know, from moment to moment, I could be doing something and I'd be fine. But overall, I think if I'm vaguely coming into a sort of a better way of dealing with the world and things. And the more I do that, the more I think you can kind of play anything. It is true you're limited to some extent, but you're mostly limited by your own imagination. And I think that's true. I don't think it used to be that way. You just couldn't break through. You know, if you were a woman who wasn't beautiful and had a certain kind of figure or whatever, you could not be a movie star in 1940. But there are some very unusual looking movie stars, you know, these days. And it's great. They believe in themselves, and so other people believe them, I think. I think that's more important.
Do you feel like it had to take as long as it did for you to really have that in an organic way, or do you wish that you had understood it fully when you were 19?
Oh, I wish I could have understood everything when I was 19, and I wish I could understand everything now. But at least I've begun, and you know what? I know people. I don't have all this knowledge or anything, but I wish I could convince people. I have friends who say, but I'm 63 and I don't even, you know, and I've only done this. And it's like, well, Grandma Moses started when she was like 73. You should not put limits on yourself. The world puts enough limits on you. If it takes you your whole life to do something or to be comfortable with it or to learn what you should be doing, that's how long it was supposed to take. You know, it's so useless to say, oh, I wish I could have and would have. Of course, I feel that way often, but I try to temper it. You know, I try to go, you know, it took that long. I had a lot to deal with, and I was lucky anyway. I still got to do an awful lot of things. I could have just enjoyed them and done better. But, I was lucky, and at least I'm sort of getting to a place that is much more comfortable for me.
I want to talk about the multiple roles that you have played in Christopher Guest's semi-improvised movies.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, talk if you would about...
They're completely improvised in the real sense of improvisation. You get a suggestion like, there's a dog show tomorrow and you have to get together. But it doesn't say, and he talks about this and she talks about that, for the most part. It's just kind of like, let's see what happens.
Wow. I mean, how do you balance the need to not be afraid of trying a bunch of different things with the need to sort of, you know, self-regulate and be aware of what everyone else is doing? Can you speak a little bit about that line?
Well, the thing about the Christopher Guest movies that is why they're so much fun, he's very careful who he casts in those movies. There are an awful lot of funny people that don't end up in those movies, and there are some of us, me especially, who isn't really particularly funny. I'm not any great comedian. I could not survive in Second City, you know, in front of people the way Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara and so many of those other people do, and Jane Lynch and everybody else. But in in the guest movies, they're very much about, they're very truthful in a funny sort of way. I mean, we say outlandish things sometimes, but they're very much based in reality. And Chris encourages all of us to talk and to listen and to not try to be funny. If we were just all out there trying to get in the next best line, we'd be walking all over each other. We really would. I mean, you would just try to top everybody. And when you watch the movies, you know, there are definitely funny things, and there are even jokes sometimes. But really when magic strikes, which it doesn't all the time in any movie, but in Chris's movies, there are enough of those magical moments so that they're really worth waiting for, I think. They happen because something organic is happening, and that only happens when people are working as a team in improvisation. I mean, you can be a movie star and never look anybody in the eye and trample over everybody, and you don't even notice anybody else in the movie. But I still think great movie stars are great listeners, and great movie stars want to be surrounded by other great actors because they want their movies to do well, because if they don't do well, then you don't do well. But I would say in Chris's movies, more than anything I've ever done, there is a real feeling of camaraderie. And even though they're supposed to be funny, and traditionally comedians are much more cutthroat and have to be because it's so much harder to be funny in a way, there's a surprising amount of very, very respectful people in those things, respectful of each other and whatever they're doing. It's just so much fun to do.
Are there variations in the people who are participating in a scene? In other words, one actor would do really well with three or four takes, but it is worn out by the time you get to a dozen. And how do you do that?
You don't really get worn out in Chris's movies because, first of all, you never have to repeat anything. I mean, he can suggest that you do sort of the same thing, but you don't have to. Oddly enough, to me, because I watch this as a director, you know, I try to pick up things as a director as well, repetition's fine. You can do the same scene hundreds of times and keep finding better things in it, depending on how you got to the repetition. If you get to the thing you're doing by working through it, by finding it honestly, by discovering it as you went along, which is what you have to do when you're doing your first take or two of improvising, you can actually redo that for days. You know, I've been in plays I've done 200 performances of something, you know, day after day after day, and found it very, very fulfilling. As long as I had a strong base in it, you know, as long as I rehearsed it, which is in improvisation, all the stuff you do is like a great rehearsal for doing another take or whatever you do the next day. It just keeps you grounded in your character and exploring your character in a way that you never get to do in a scripted movie.
Do you feel a direct link between what you do as an actor and as a director and what you would do in front of your computer when you're writing?
I try to. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of frighteningly the same, which is, if you don't really know what you're doing, you know, you better write this thing because you have to get the kids to the party tomorrow or whatever. You can't just write any old thing you're thinking of. You actually sort of have to live through it. And you can't always control when that happens, which is why it takes you more than a week to write a book, because you would think you could write a book, you know, in about as long as it takes to type it. You could just write it out. But I do find that whenever I'm good, when I am good in something, it's probably for the same reason in whatever aspect of whatever you call it, writing or directing or producing or anything, acting. It's all probably because your impulse was not from your head, it was from something in your unconscious. And you have to, you know, we're always trying to access that all the time. And we can't always do it, which is why we must have some form of technique to get us through, you know, the rough spots. But what I notice when I'm working with a great actor, I notice they sort of sketch everything in, but they make these building blocks for themselves. They're never unreal. They're not always inspired, because you can see they're thinking, they're working their way through it. And if they do it carefully enough, it creates a situation in which this amazing thing happens, and life happens. And it really happens. There are some really good actors to whom it never happens, but they're so good at pretending it's happening that it sort of gets them through, and they can even win awards and things. But when you're working with somebody truly great, you know, whether they're movie stars or just somebody who came in for the day to say something, it's a gift that anybody can have. They don't have to be successful necessarily. But when that happens and you're around and you watch it, you crave it for yourself, for one thing, and you become aware that there is something that transcends your intentions, if you're lucky and you keep your eyes open and you're around a long enough time. But you know, you have to be willing to wait for it. You can't pounce on it.
Is there something about celebrity culture that gets in the way of the art?
Acting, directing, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, those of us who've never been on a movie set maybe still imagine that these giant personalities end up. And I wonder if some of that has to be checked at the door or else you're never going to get any work done.
Well, I think there are all kinds of movie stars. I won't say anything bad about anybody, but a fair amount of movie stars, especially these days, because we don't live in a studio system anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We're not protected. You have to work in different movies, and your movies have to gross a certain amount. Well, they always did, I suppose. But you were really protected before. Nobody knew how you acted. It just didn't get out. You still don't really know how certain people were. Now you have a better idea of it, I suppose. Still, there are fabulous movie stars. I've never actually worked with George Clooney, but I've been around him a little bit, enough to sense and phone. I can piece together from my friends who've been in his movies. He's an example of somebody for whom celebrity he's really coped with it well. I mean, you have to cope with it. It's an asset because it brings you money and it gets you jobs, but it's not an asset for your work particularly. So it can isolate people and it can make them, more difficult to work with, and it can make it more difficult for them to do their best work. And, it's a rubbery answer I'm giving, but sometimes movie stars are movie stars because they don't grow and change. You don't want your favorite movie star to suddenly discover that they have an emotional range if they're John Wayne. You wouldn't want that.
Yeah.
John Wayne was a package. You buy a movie star as a package. Nowadays, because you don't get to be in that many movies when you're a movie star, and you appear in all different movies, mostly movie stars appeared in the same sort of kind of movie most of the time. You didn't see Cary Grant, although he did it once in a while, but you mostly didn't see Cary Grant, appearing in a dramatic role particularly. He could do it. But nowadays, movie stars tend to be more versatile. And to some extent, it makes them be better actors, and to some extent, it makes them be less gigantic movie stars.
Actor, writer, and director Bob Balaban is my guest. He's got a new book out called The Creature from the Seventh Grade. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer, actor, and director Bob Balaban, author of The Creature from the Seventh Grade, which is the first in a new series of books he's writing for middle grade readers. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. So, Bob, the movie that I saw you in most recently was Wes Anderson's Moonrise Kingdom, and I thought it was an interesting part for you because there were virtually no conventions for you to draw from in playing this character.
That's true.
So how did you arrive at what he would be?
It was easy because Wes is so smart and writes so well. So when you read, on the one hand, I could have done it a lot of different ways, but when I read that movie, the script was so compelling, everything about it, and I sort of, without talking about it with Wes, I got the feeling of how necessary my small but fun part was as the narrator, because I got the feeling that it was deeply connected to his basic impulse in writing the movie, which is that, yes, it's about a dysfunctional family, two of them. Yes, it's about these amazing children who were so well-written and so well-played and directed. They're just brilliant, I think. But it's also a movie about storytelling. That's how it's written. It's about the power of stories, which is why he starts breaking down even the opera Noah's Flood into components of, practical creation. It's a lot about creating art. And once I figured that out or felt that way, I kind of got a real sense of this narrator as being not tacked on in some way, but he was a part of it. He was as much a part of it as the books that the young girl read that sort of propelled her to be part of the story. and that was a big help. When I got to shooting, my part shot the first week and the last week of the movie because I didn't have to be there with anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Although there was one scene when I come upon them having a fight with a shoe with Bruce Willis and Francis McDormand and Bill Murray and Ed Norton. They're all on the on a pier somewhere in Rhode Island. All I know is wherever we went, it had ticks. There were more ticks. And I live in Bridgehampton, and there are a lot of ticks here. But the ticks in Rhode Island are superior to everyone. I mean, they're just more of them, and they're bigger. So that was the one time I had to interact with the other actors. But for the first week when I got there, it was just me and Wes and the camera crew, and it was very relaxed. And the first thing Wes did when he got me there was invite me over for dinner. Because, you know, a lot of directors don't know that if you make an actor feel comfortable, you sort of, you know, you can sort of have them eating out of the palm of your hand, literally, mm-hmm. actually. And Wes is very comfortable, and it spreads, and he knows what he's doing, and it makes you feel secure. So that one of the first things he did was sat me down at a little moviolo, you know, a device where he could screen it for me or whatever, and he had done test footage of the first section of me being a narrator. Now, you know, I probably do it for a grand total of a minute and a half or 2 minutes. That's the scene. But every time I open my mouth to speak, I'm in a different location, and it just sort of continues. So I wouldn't really have had much of a feeling for it technically, except Wes had cut himself together being the narrator. And he showed me what I looked like my character would look like in the frame. And there was something that was tremendously informative about seeing Wes playing me. He wasn't trying to act in any way. In fact, he read it literally like, and now we're here, and now we're going there. I mean, he literally tried not to give me line readings or anything, but seeing him, and he wasn't wearing my funny, weird costume either, but seeing him in the frame, cutting the way he was cutting it, instantly made me feel at home, and I knew what to do. And I can't really tell you what it was. I just know that it made me feel like I would be adequate, that I would kind of know what to do. And from then on, I was just happy to be there. And Wes is great with dealing with people.
Well, I think it works perfectly. I mean, you are amazing. And there is something about that very odd framing that changes all the time that's compelling. It makes you want to watch.
Well, there is a little truth here. You can be in the largest part in the best movie directed by a bad director, and nothing, and you might as well not show up. You can have a little part like I had in a movie where the director is, frankly, a genius, but don't tell him I said that. I mean, he knows we all love him. But the director makes you look good. It's not your screen time necessarily that helps. It's because somebody puts you in a frame, in a costume, with another actor, with a part, and inherently knows what to do, and that's what Wes does with everybody in the movie. I mean, it's no surprise that everybody in the movie is just, it's one of their best performances, I think. And there are some really good people in there.
What is it like to have to do a press tour on a project that you realize is not what you had hoped it would be?
But that's most of the time.
Really?
So we're kind of used to that, you know? And trust, I'm not aware of these press junkets as having the same velocity that they used to, or I mean as being as big and long and drawn out.
Well, they're expensive, I guess.
Well,
right?
Mostly now they happen with $200 million movies. They don't, and, you know, in the little $5 million movies that I'm in often, they have little ones, but it, you know, it doesn't feel like that. Moonrise Kingdom was one of the first ones I've been participating in for a couple of years that really did that. I mean, first of all, we were in Cannes for the opening of the film festival. That was, you know, no movie. Most movies don't get to do that, so you never get to experience that. And everybody wants to hear and see and feel the movie. And there was a standing ovation for like 10 minutes when it was over. And French people boo, you know. So this, you know, it wasn't just half the people that stood. They all stood and nobody booed. It was amazing. And that was a pleasure because, you know, you love it. To me, it's your job. I mean, especially if the movie needs help and it's not great and it's limping along, I mean, nobody really cares if I show up at these things or not too much. But I suppose as the movies get littler, it is more important that all the cast members show up. And I feel it's part of your job if you sign on, unless there's been some horrible breach and, you know, and somebody has done something terrible to you or your friend, the director, or something, in which case, yes, I wouldn't show up probably. But I always do everything I can to promote it because I want everybody to promote the things I'm doing. I'm directing a play that opens in New York next week, and I want Stockard Channing and Brian Dennehy and Delroy Lindo and everybody to show up when we're on the Joy Behar show. I want them to come and do that. And so, you know, I'm so often on the other side that I'm more like a producer than an actor, or a director than an actor anyway. And my sense is you got to support what you do.
Well, tell us about the play that's coming up.
The play is called The Exonerated. Do you know anything about it?
I've read just a tiny bit. But
okay, well, then I'll tell you, so I won't be redundant then, because
all right,
you don't know that much. This was an evening that we did 10 years ago in New York. These two really smart young people, Eric Jensen and Jessica Blank, who I had worked with as young actors, came to me with 1,500 pages of testimony of 40 men and women who had been on death row, who were innocent and had been released from prison.
They did interviews with these people, is that right?
They went around and did interviews at their kitchen tables, basically. They were all out of prison because that's what the movie was about. I mean, the play. It was about getting through this process and coming out the other side. So we started with that. We then, together, wove together these people's lives in sort of 14-minute increments, because there were six people and the play lasts about 100 minutes. So we went back and we collected opening and closing statements from the prosecution and the defense. We got depositions from their interrogations. We got letters that their husbands and wives wrote to them when they were in prison. And we got signed confessions from people who admitted to doing the killings that they had spent 22 years in jail for. So we had all this material. And then we had to figure out how to do it. So I got 10 actors, put them on stools, and decided we would not act it out. We would read it from books in front of us like it was testimony from court. But the trick would be that everybody would have rehearsed it forever and actually memorized it and really inhabited their characters. But it gives the illusion to the audience that they're reading testimony. So never do you forget that this is Sonny Jacobs talking. It's not Jill Klaber or Stockard Channing or whoever happens to be playing her. You are hearing, you know, the life and breath of this actual person. And that's what we have. We have 10 people on stage. We have stars that rotate. It's all testimony, and it's a drama. It actually tells a story. We didn't invent a word of it. And it takes six prisoners from how they were convicted to their time spent in prison to how they got out of prison and where they are now. And some of them are destroyed, and some of them are joyous, fabulous human beings who appreciate their lives more because of this. It is not an anti-death penalty evening, although you could come away with that. It is only about how wrongful conviction really happens, more than you would like to know. And certainly most people are in jail and most people are on death row because they killed somebody. But a percentage of them are innocent, and this is how it could be when you hear that somebody confessed. This is what was behind some of the confessions, and it's not what you thought. It's really, they're fascinating stories. We open with Stockard Channing and Brian Dennehy and Delroy Lindo and Christopher Sarandon and other wonderful people at the Culture Project, which is a lovely off-Broadway theater where we did the play 10 years ago and got lots of awards and lovely reviews, and we're doing it again, and we start previewing this coming Saturday. If I'm tired, that's why.
You sound fine. Is your goal to make people realize it could be them?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, because the first thing that happens when somebody goes into prison is you stop thinking of them as people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's much like the way people wear any uniform. If somebody has been your waiter for 100 years, don't you notice this? I mean, and you know, I like to think I'm very enlightened in all sorts of ways. But if I know somebody and they're in a job where they wear a uniform, when I see them in the real world, I'm like, my goodness, you're so like me. You know, you're wearing a tie. You have on attractive clothing. You fixed your hair, or you wore makeup today. And multiply that times a million, and that's how we feel about people in prison. They have numbers. You make the assumption they've done something terrible, no matter what they did or didn't do. And I wanted, for myself as well, I wanted to really get inside people. I can't, and I'm always amazed, the people who see this evening, they've been changed from it for the most part, and I think in somewhat the same way I have been, which is I cannot read about almost anything in the paper or hear it on the news without going, is that the real story? There's something that they've done to this story to make it entertaining, to make it be a headline, to make it be somewhere, and even the most guilty-looking person might be innocent, which is not to say that, you know, there aren't mostly terrible people out there committing crimes. But you got to keep your eyes open, because our community, the world that we live in, is appropriately afraid of monsters. and mostly monsters. Many of the killings are done by monsters. They're just not somebody who pulled a trigger by mistake. A lot of them are just terrible career murderers. But it makes us be much less sympathetic to the people who get caught in the net. And I'm trying to make us realize that the people who are caught in the net deserve our help and attention and love and care as much as the victims of these crimes do, because they're victims too.
Have people who have been exonerated, whose stories are told in this, I mean, I understand that some of them attended the first performances.
Uh-huh. And Sunny, who is a friend of ours at this point, is going to play herself in one of the weeks of the thing. And some of the people in it will also be there to do talkbacks at the end of the show. And the audience generally finds it very overwhelming when the person stands in front of them, because you kind of get to feel that you've really been in their lives, even though the play is only 98 minutes. You do get a real feeling of having been bonded with somebody. So it's very, very powerful for them.
And is there a creative value, Bob, to the limitations presented by saying we are only going to have the actual dialogue, we're not going to change things?
Yeah, it's creatively tremendously helpful, because we have to cut everything down, because, you know, every person could have, you know, 2 weeks of what they said, and their court documents could go on for 6 months if you wanted to. But in the cutting of it, it gets very distilled. So their personalities become much more evident. When you know somebody very well, which is to say you've listened to them for a long time, you're not so aware of their vocal patterns, the poetry in their speech. When you take the things that these people say and you remove all the extraneous stuff like pass the butter and let's sit down for dinner now, and you leave the parts where they are really speaking from their hearts, you leave this beautiful poetic document that also has the power of you knowing that it's absolutely true and they said it. So it's got both. It's much more compressed than real speech, but it is real speech, and it's very powerful. In this case, it just happens to be we were all very lucky in dealing with some wonderful people.
So you've got all this going on. You are still writing the series. Talk about how you find the time, and is it something that's refreshing for you to sit down and write for 3 hours?
Sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sometimes it's the most fun thing, and it makes my day be really happy. And then sometimes it's the opposite. But I'm not really a writer, you know. I mean, I've sort of put together movies and sort of rewritten them or sort of created them. But it's different from it's your own and you're alone there and you're writing it. And I've talked to more people now, and I discover that it's a wall you have to get through. And when you get through it, it's so much fun because it writes itself. It actually does. You know the characters. Something happens. And then you might think it would be there tomorrow, and suddenly it's not. But that's why it's exciting. It's a surprise all the time.
The new book by writer, actor, and director Bob Balaban is The Creature from the Seventh Grade. Bob, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, you were so much fun to talk to. I really enjoyed it. Thanks.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can find out about upcoming programs and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.